Okay, Chanukah Sameach, everybody. Erev Tov. Welcome. First night of Chanukah. Hope everybody's doing well. It should be Chag Urim Sameach, that have lots of light. There's a lot of darkness in the world, so let's please God hope that this Chanukah will usher in a very warm period, a very wonderful period. Tonight's shiur is being sponsored by Pessy and Asher Reimer in memory of Asher's father, Julius Reimer Yehuda ben Harav Yosef Tov. Neshama should have an aliyah, and we should have good things and celebrate happy occasions. Thank you to the Reimers. It's a pleasure to welcome, you know, Dr. Aaron Kohler. He spoke, if those of you who remember, back in the summer as part of our 24 and 8 series in Tanakh. And it's a pleasure to welcome back. He's a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Yeshiva University, chair of the department, the Barron Department of Jewish Studies. He's the author of The Unbinding of Isaac. The book recently came out. It was recently reviewed in Tradition. I have not had a chance yet to read it, but please God, and you know, before next year's Akedat Yitzchak. And it's gotten good reviews. There was just a write-up on it in Tradition, author of many other books. And he's been a visiting professor at Hebrew University. He just heard his parents live in Israel. And it's a pleasure to welcome him from Queens, New York, to our rotating Parsha Shir. Bakasha, Dr. Kohler.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. And I have to thank Pessy and Asher. So Asher, I assume we're just a few blocks apart? Is that okay? Oh, that's nice. Very nice. That's a treat for me. Asher was actually one of the early so he was help on that. Okay, so we're going to get started. I was thinking, should we do a Chanukah shiur? Had some thoughts on that, and then I thought, well, no, it is a Parsha shiur. I don't really know if other people only do the Parsha, but it's a Parsha slot. I should do a Parsha shiur. And then thinking, what's the connection between Vayeshev and Chanukah? And, you know, there are things to say. And I thought, you know what? This is silly. All the stories about the dreidel, it's all about how we weren't allowed to learn Torah. So what's more Chanukah than just learning Torah? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to open the Parsha and we're going to learn some parts of the story of Mechirat Yosef. And I feel like that's the epitome of celebrating Chanukah. So I'm going to share my screen, put some images up. I think these were shared, or a slightly earlier version of this was shared in advance. So if you can follow with mine, that would be slightly preferable because it's a little bit updated, but it's 90% the same. So if you have it and you prefer to look at your own, that's certainly more than fine. What I'm going to do is break this shiur into a couple of parts. And after each one, I will pause for some comments, questions. If anyone wants to put something in the chat, that would be fine. I'll break it up partly just to break it up and partly also so that if you do have questions, we don't have to come back to it in 45 or 50 minutes, but we can take it more or less as we get to the, as we wrap up that topic. Okay, so the story of Mechirat Yosef. Lots of really fascinating things going on. We're talking about essentially Perek Lamed Zayin, and really we are really going to be dealing with the second half of Perek Lamed Zayin. I do want to acknowledge that I have learned a lot from a lot of different sources, including, as you'll see, both Rishonim and modern scholarship, Chazal to a little extent. But I do want to single out two recent articles that I learned a particularly large amount from, both by my teacher, Richard Steiner. One was published this year called Contradictions, Culture Gaps, and Narrative Gaps in the Joseph Story. And the other one, called Midianite Men and an Egyptian Man, Ambiguity and Contradiction, Light for Steel and Foreshadowing. So I gave you the link to one of them, but I'm happy to talk more about them. I'll mention him by name once or twice over the course of this year when he had a particular point, but I do want to mention that that a lot of this year was inspired by reading these articles. Okay, so the first section, the actual sale of Yosef. How did this happen? And the question of Reuven. So first, some basic geography. I know this is all familiar. It's Yaakov is living down south, down in the center of the country. The Avot live more or less entirely in the hill country, except when they go down to the Negev. Hill country being, as you know, the spine of Israel, which runs now right, in large part through the West Bank or just along the Green Line, which is hilly, right? And we know if you go to the east, you get into the Jordan Valley to the north, the Dead Sea, the Judean Desert farther down south. And if you go to the west, you get to the Shvela and then to the coastal plain. But that central hill country, that's where the Avot spend much of their time. And remember where Yaakov sends his sons, or his sons go out, Lerot et Hatzon, they go up to Shechem, right? Which of course, modern Nablus, so right there, still in the hill country. And that's the thing I want to emphasize right now. So the brothers go up towards the north, still in the mountains. These are not mountains like the Rockies, about 1,000 feet up, 1,500 feet up, very hilly. And they go up to that area of Shechem. And of course, Yaakov and Yosef, before Yosef goes to find them, doesn't know that they're not in that area. So if we zoom in here, so Nablus is here now towards the bottom of the picture. The little red arrow thing is marking Tel Dotan, modern Tel Dotan, the site of Dotan, which is where the brothers had gone in the story. So just to remind ourselves of the very basic narrative, the brothers left Yaakov, 10 of the brothers left Yaakov, they go up to Shechem, they then leave Shechem and go to Dotan. Yosef comes after them, goes to Shechem, because that's where he expects to find them. And he gets there and doesn't find the brothers. And unbeknownst to him, they were up farther north at Dotan. But before we see what happens to Yosef, I just want you to notice that the topography is very different up at Dotan. So you can see this on the map, which is why it's here. Dotan is in the sort of extension of the Jezreel Valley. This is Imek Yisrael that goes east to west across Israel from Beit Shan and that area across over to the west, to the Mediterranean Sea. And Dotan is just to the south of this, but also in a fertile valley that connects to it. So of course, on the one hand, it's not surprising that the brothers who had trouble finding grazing grounds for the sheep at Shechem here in the hill country, decided to go farther north. This is a long trip. This is not a 3-day trip. They are out clearly for weeks or even months. Today, Bedouin who travel with their flocks go for half the year. They'll go leave the dry areas and go to the grassy areas and then come back 6 months later. So I don't know how long the brothers were planning on being away for, but it was not a short trip. And at some point they left Shechem and they go to the fertile area around Dotan. Now, we pick up the story in the text here. So Yaakov tells Yosef to leave the valley of Hebron all the way down south and go up to Shechem. And he gets to Shechem. So a man finds him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" "I'm looking for my brothers. Could you tell me where they're shepherding?" And the man says, "So the first thing to observe is that the chances of meeting a guy who happens to have overheard the brothers talking don't seem all that high. And he meets a guy wandering around Shechem, Haish, unnamed, who not only does he know who Yosef's brothers were, which might not be so surprising because 10 men coming with large flocks to the area may have been noticeable, but he even knows when they left, where they went to. So that seems like a remarkable coincidence. But the other coincidence, and this is where the topography is so important, or understanding the geography is so important, another coincidence is that had Yosef found the brothers in Shechem, the whole story could not have taken place. The rest of what we're about to hear, the whole sale of Yosef to a caravan and to Egypt and so on, couldn't have happened. The only reason that was possible is because he found the brothers up north near the Emek Yisrael. That's where a caravan would pass through. A caravan would never pass by Shechem in the middle of the hill country because no caravan is going to cross those mountains. They will loop up north and pass through the flat valley to get from the Beit Shan Valley over to the coastal plain. And only because Yosef found the brothers in Dothan and not in Shechem could the story unfold the way it did. So that's a lot of apparent coincidences. And those coincidences are all the more striking when we realize that Perek Lamed Zayin in Bereishit is the first story, the first narrative in Bereishit where Hashem doesn't appear at all. This is the first story in Torah, since we started at the beginning of Bereishit, that God's just not in the story. Hashem's been the central character in the Torah up until this point, obviously with a cast of characters that go in and out in various relationships with him. But this is the first chapter, the entire Perek Lamed Zayin, there's just no God mentioned at all. I certainly don't mean to say that God's not involved. As we'll see, on the contrary, later on, Yosef's going to say that this whole thing was God, but it's the first time that God doesn't overtly get involved, talk to people, do something, actually act in a direct way. And that absence of God, coupled with these remarkable coincidences, that there's a mysterious man who knows exactly where the brothers were, and the brothers happen to be in a place that allows a caravan to pass by, is what gives the sense to a lot of readers for, you know, at least the last 2,500 years, that this is a story about God, about Hashgacha Pratit, when God is Nistar, when God is hidden. Unlike some of the stories with Avram and Yaakov, and Yitzchak, where Hashem is much more directly involved, this is a story where God is behind the scenes, and yet it's the first time we see strings being pulled from behind the scenes. So it's also not surprising that, for example, when the author of Megillat Esther wants to allude to stories in Torah, the stories in Chumash, as a precedent for the story that he wants to tell in Megillat Esther, which also involves no overt involvement of Hashem, but a lot of coincidences that seem to just work out way too well to be just coincidences, he alludes repeatedly to the story of Yosef, because Yosef's the first time that we see this absence of an overt involvement of God, but with these coincidences. So again, the most important thing is just to observe that the geography works out really well, that because the brothers have moved up north to Dothan, that's why the rest of the story can happen the way it does. All right, there's the Dothan Valley. Do want to point out, so I mentioned these caravans that pass through. There's a fairly serious historical question about camel caravans and when camel caravans started coming in earnest. And there's a lot written about this. There were camels domesticated and used 1,000 years. I shouldn't say that. 500 years before started the Avot, by the late third millennium. By the late 2000s, we have good evidence of camels being used in different places. Camel caravans are later, but you see over here, you see Dothan, right? So now it's labeled here towards the top left of your map. And you see just on the other side of the Jordan River, towards the bottom right of your map, you see Dar Allah. From Dar Allah, from later in the start time of Yosef, but from about, probably about 1200 or so BCE, archaeologists found this little shard of pottery with a picture, which is in fact a picture of a camel caravan, or at least two camels. I assume it was a caravan. There's tons of evidence for caravans later on, but this is really lovely because here we have the caravan that picks up Yosef over in the Dothan Valley, almost certainly would have come up through Dar Allah. So it's not surprising that people in Dar Allah are drawing camel caravans. Again, this is centuries later. This is a route that the caravans would have taken as they come through the Arabian Peninsula, bringing their frankincense and their other spices, other import goods, come up across the Levant across the land of Israel over to the Mediterranean coast. And from there, they can go to the Phoenicians up north and go to the Egyptians down south. They can go all over the world. Anyway, so that's the caravans. Okay. Actually, let me pause here. What did see? There was already a couple of things in the chat. So let me pause for a second. So one question. So where was Yaakov living? Right. So I should have said that more clearly. It does say in the pasuk that we looked at that he sent Yosef from Emek Chevron up to Shechem. So of course, Chevron is really far south. I should have looked up exactly how many miles, but we're talking about many dozens of miles. And again, you know, this is not a trip for a weekend or even for a week. You have to assume the brothers were gone for months grazing their cattle. There are times of the year where the Negev is fertile enough to support these flocks, but there are times of the year where it's not. And this is presumably the warmer months where the brothers have to take the flocks up north and find fertile land. Maris wrote, didn't most caravans from the east follow the Jordan River south and then west through Machtesh Ramon? That's a great question. There are basically two options, as you say. So a caravan, using the information we have from later, from let's, you know, New Assyrian times, we actually have a lot of information about these caravans. They come up through the Arabian Peninsula, and then they have these two options. Either they go up north through Megiddo, through the Israel Valley, or as you say, they hook down south and just cross the Negev. You obviously don't want to go through the Machtesh because that's a ridiculous thing to make your camels do. But the Negev generally, obviously for the camels, you know, if you cross the Arabian Peninsula, crossing the Negev is no big deal. A lot of it actually depends later on, at least on political circumstances. Where are you going to be safer? So there was actually some sort of economic competition between the king of Yehuda and the king of Israel. We think about the north being the king of Israel, the south being the king of Yehuda. They each wanted the caravans to cross through their territory because it was very lucrative. They charged taxes. People got rich off this. But you're exactly right, Maris, that those are the two options. Either you go north through the valley or you go south through the desert. Fantastic. Okay, so great. Let's go back to our slides then. Okay, so we pick up the story now. The brothers, after they see Yosef coming, they have this plan. I'm skipping a lot of the details. I'm skipping the dialogue with Yehuda and the other brothers and Reuven and the brothers at first as well. But Vayishvu le'echol lechem, Vayis'u einehem vayiru, V'hinei orchat yishmeilim ba'a migilad u'gmalehem nosim nechot u'tzri valot hochim lahorid mitzrayma. So the brothers sit down to a meal, and looking up, they see a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilad, in the east. Their camels bearing gum, balm, ladanum to be taken to Egypt. To be clear, they can't see all these details from where they are. They see a caravan of camels, and the rest of this is sort of an inference. They must be Ishmaelites. Those are the people who run camel caravans. And they're presumably carrying Nechot Utsri Valot. Obviously, from this distance, we still have some time until the caravan gets here. There's no way that the brothers could have made out the ethnicity of the people riding the camels or what exactly the camels are carrying. This is essentially the stereotype. This is the kind of caravan that's coming. And then I skipped some of the dialogue. Vayavru, Anashim Midyanim, Socharim, וימשכו ויעלו את יוסף מן הבור וימכרו את יוסף לישמעאלים ב-20 כסף ויביאו את יוסף מצרימה. So this pasuk, I put a translation on. I thought about not putting a translation at all because the pasuk has a lot of ambiguities. So ויעברו, they passed by, אנשים מדיינים, we're like, wait, מדיינים, מדיינites, what happened to the Ishmaelites? סוחרים, merchants, fantastic, they pulled Yosef out of the pit. Who did? Wait, Yishmaelim are the same as Midyanim, or is this someone else? Obviously, to some extent, that depends on who pulled Yosef out of the pit. For 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Yosef to Mitzrayim. That's got to be the Yishmaelim, we would think, although there are, at least in theory, some other possibilities at all as well. Picking up again with what seems clearer, Vayashov Ruvain al Habor, Vine Ein Yosef Babor. Vayikra Pegadav. Reuven then comes back to the pit and sees that Yosef is not there. He tears his clothes. Vayashav elachav vayomar, hayalad inenu va'ani ana aniva. So Reuven comes back, sees that Yosef is not there, goes to his brothers and says, the boy's not here. What am I going to do? Literally, to where will I go? To where will I enter? Okay. Now, the Dutch biblical scholar, Jan Fokeman, who has a number of really very insightful books on literary analyses of Tanakh, they're generally too long and too expensive to actually read the entire thing, but they're really insightful. He points out this. He says, look, Reuven's discovery represents a gap for the reader. As we're reading, in other words, as we the readers are reading, we're like, wait, I don't understand. I'm missing some information here. Because in verse 29, we suddenly realize that Reuven could not have been a participant in the transaction. Right? As we're reading, we thought that whoever was involved in Pasuk Kavchet included Reuven, that he, along with the rest of the brothers, was involved in the sale. But then he shows up. He comes back to the pit and he sees that Yosef's not there. And we're just caught off guard. Where was Reuven? So, of course, this gap, this absence of information that we now realize we had, just needs to be explained. So where was he? So, of course, there's a famous, Rashi very famously comments, channeling Bereshit Rabba. The two of views that Rashi quotes are both in Bereshit Rabba. Rashi says, Vayashav Reuven, v'machirato lo yasham. But Reuven wasn't there when Yosef was sold. Shehigia yomo lelech u'shamesh et aviv. Because it was his turn to go home and to serve his father. In other words, Rashi is, again, channeling Bereshit Rabba, arguing that the brothers were taking turns going home to take care of their elderly father. Davar acher asukaya b'sako v'ta'anito al bilbu yitzvei aviv. And the other opinion, which is actually the first opinion of Bereshit Rabba, is that he was refraining from participating in this big meal because he was still lamenting, mourning, repenting for the really serious sin that we heard in the last parah, two parakim ago, for having disturbed his father's bed, which, as you recall, the Torah said he slept with Bilhah, with his father's pilegesh. So that's one approach. But Yosef Bechor Shor, a slightly later French commentator, Baal HaTosafot, among other things, a student of Rabbeinu Tam. He quotes, as I put this a little bit out of order in his comment, but he quotes Rashi, he quotes the two opinions, whether he's quoting Rashi or he's quoting Bereshit Rabba is sort of beside the point. But he says, Yesh omrim ki Reuven haya mitaneh sheshachavat bilhav, Yesh omrim shaya kol echad meshamesh et avihem yomo, v'hige yomo shor Reuven. So these two views that are in Bereshit Rabba and Rashi. Aval tema, ashayu rechokim me'avihem. Reuven Shavalabor. But he makes the absolutely correct point that it's entirely implausible that anyone is going back to take care of their father for a day or two. We're talking about a journey of many days just to get there. So there's no way that Reuven left in the morning, made lunch for his father and came back before supper time. So he rejects these two views. And Bechor Shor, which I should say is available online, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the website alhatorah.org and the their Mikraot Gedolot module, mg.alhatorah.org, which is phenomenal. So the Bechor Shor's commentary is available there, but this is a text that I learned of from Dr. Steiner's article. Bechor Shor says, but there's actually a much more intuitive realistic explanation for where Reuven was. Derech haroim shemiktatam ochlim umiktatan umdim al habehemot. Va'achar she'achlu miktatam ochlim otam she'achlu al habehemot va'achirim ochlim. Ve'in darkam le'echol kulam biyachad. Ve'ya ochel Yehuda miktat echav v'Reuven miktat echav v'yu shomrim atzon ulfichach lo yeda Reuven b'machirato. So where was Reuven? He says, well, if you're a shepherd, it's obvious to you where Reuven was. The brothers can't all sit down and eat a meal together. Who's taking care of the sheep? We're talking about a flock of probably thousands of sheep. Who's taking care of them if all the brothers are sitting and eating? No shepherd, no group of shepherds can do that. And in fact, that's why there are groups of shepherds. You help each other out. Some people can sleep while other people shepherd. Some people can eat while other people shepherd. So Bechor Shor surmises very realistically, very plausibly, that Yehuda and some of the brothers were eating, while Reuven and some of the brothers, I don't know who, were off shepherding. Then it was Reuven and his band's time to eat. He comes back to the boar. He apparently had a plan, or at least checked on his brother and said, oh my God, Yosef's not here. Where is he? So eminently reasonable explanation for where Reuven is. He can't be at the meal. He absolutely has to be shepherding at this point. Now, as it turns out, Reuven may never have found out what happened to Yosef. If you sort of play that out, how do the brothers respond? We don't hear in Brishis Lamed Zayin, we never hear that they answer him and say, oh, we forgot to tell you, we sold him, or like you missed it, you know, but here's your share of the guilt. And in fact, later on in Perek Membet, when the brothers are, I've already met Yosef, of course, in his later iteration, they say, so the brothers say to each other, look, we really are guilty because of our brother. We saw the pain in his soul as he was crying out to us. We didn't listen. That's why the suffering is befalling us. And Reuven says, now that phrase, v'gam damo hinei nidrash, makes it sound like he really thinks that Yosef is dead. In other words, it may actually be that he sincerely believes Tarof Toraf Yosef, that a wild chalatu, that a wild animal got Yosef. Maybe he has no idea that Yosef was sold. If he wasn't there and no one bothered to tell him, v'gam damo hinei nidrash, his blood is being avenged, makes it sound like he thinks Yosef's in fact been killed. I should also point out, and again, this is something Dr. Steiner points out, that first pasuk here on the slide, pasuk kaf aleph, where the brothers say, "Asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho bihitchanano eleinu," we saw the pain in his soul as he was beseeching us. We didn't listen. Well, that's something we didn't hear back in Perek Lamed Zayin either. We don't hear anything from Yosef as the brothers are casting him into the pit or plotting to sell him. We don't know what Yosef was doing. It's not, you know, I don't think any of us thought that he was just stoically accepting his fate, but we weren't told that he was actually pleading with them to stop, to release him, to help either. But here down in Perek Membet, we do hear that. He was pleading with us and we didn't listen. So the last thing that this point about Reuven shepherding while the other brothers ate helps with is a question that a number of commentators have asked. And this is a translation of an article, of a line from an article by Baruch Schwartz, who's a professor at the Hebrew University. And he wrote in an article on Mechirat Yosef, he says, they sat down to a meal, who cares, essentially. He writes it in a slightly more professional tone. How do these words advance the plot of the narrative? What do they contribute to the progression of the matter? And in Steiner's article, he actually gives two answers. So this is one answer that's sort of conventional answer. The usual answer to this question is that these words hint at the callous indifference displayed by the brothers, as they themselves later acknowledge, what we just read in Perek Membet as a Kabbalah. This answer is undoubtedly correct, but it's not complete. The other thing that Vayishvu Le'echol Lechem tells us, if we were shepherds, or if we just lived in a shepherding society, what we would realize is that Vayishvu Le'echol Lechem means that some, but not all of the brothers are eating, but not all of them are there. Because again, if we knew anything about shepherding, we would, of course, understand that they couldn't all be eating, and that this is the first time that in the story that we would see the brothers have to be split up. And that, of course, is important for the plot because Reuven can't be there. He apparently would have intervened and done something else had he been there. Okay, so that's about Reuven. I'm going to pause again. So let me see the chat. And then if anyone else who didn't put in the chat wants to ask a question or make any comments, I'd be more than happy. Let's see. Kind of interesting that Ishmaelim is already Gentilic in two generations. That's a group comment. What is, of course, the issue with the opinion that Reuven was fasting, repenting? Right. So that's a good point, Alana. He does not explicitly reject that. I think he sensed, and I think Rashi also senses, that that is a more midrashic interpretation. There is no hint anywhere in the text that Reuven is repenting for his sin, and certainly nothing to connect that to this particular meal, that he wouldn't have been at this meal. We don't know whether he felt guilty in general. We certainly don't have any reason to think that he had to opt out of this meal because of that. As I said, Rashi actually reverses the order of the opinions in Bereishit Rabbah, and it may well be that he actually also did that because he sensed that the one about Reuben going home and taking care of his father, he thought was plausible. Like on a pshat level, that may make sense. But the one about Reuben opting out of the meal because he was Osteik b'sako v'tanito, I think that struck Rashi and I think B'chor Shor as well as overly midrashic and therefore not a really serious interpretation of the question. Okay, besides the chat, anyone have any comments or questions that you want to make at this point? Nope, fantastic. Everything is absolutely clear, certain, and there's no open ends here at all. Wonderful. So then we will go back to part two. Who sold Yosef to whom? So that's the pasuk that we looked at a few minutes ago that I said has all sorts of ambiguities in it. How did Yosef actually get to Mitzrayim? Well, one question that's, I think it should be put on the table, but it's probably not a real question, is, was Yosef sold? Well, later on he says, Kigunov gunavti meretz ha'ivrim. That he doesn't say I was sold. He says I was stolen. But of course, that's not in contradiction to being sold. That's presumably the first part of it. I was kidnapped and then I was sold. So of course, you could emphasize one or the other. In Perek Mem, when Yosef's already in Mitzrayim, he emphasizes the fact that he was kidnapped. We are going to focus on the sale part of it, not the kidnapping, but how he actually got to Egypt. Whose hands did he pass through? So I put up on the slide here a bit of an extended excerpt from the story where I bolded all of the terms that seem to refer to various people who sort of come in and out of the story. Like if you were imagining the story as a stage, some of them are walking behind the stage, on the stage, across the stage, off the stage. So, and it gets a little bit confusing. So let's see what we have here. So we start with the brothers, Vayisu Einehem. They lift up their eyes, Vayiru, V'hine Orchat Yishmaelim Ba'am Gilad. So they see a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilad. So we already saw that. Great. And Yehuda says, what do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Let's go sell him to those Yishmaelim. Again, the Yishmaelim, the caravan at this point is probably, I think almost certainly too distant for them to actually see the faces of the people, see what they're wearing, probably see anything about the people at all. All they see is that there is a dust storm around the camel caravan. And they say, okay, let's go sell them to the Ishmaelim. Then, pasuk kafchet, vayavru anashim midyanim socharim. They passed Midianite merchant men, and then the pasuk that I keep saying is tricky. Vayim shechu, they pulled up. Vayalu at Yosef min abor, they lifted Yosef from the pit. Vayim kiru at Yosef la Ishmaelim. They sold Yosef to the Ishmaelim. Fine. Then the Reuven scene that we already talked about, the scene where the brothers come back. I actually don't know how much later this was that they came back. Torah doesn't make a big deal about whether it was, you know, later that afternoon, which of course they couldn't have gotten there, but you know, did they set out immediately? Did they wait a few weeks? There's no real indication. But then when you get to the end of the parak, the last pasuk, the Hamidanim machro to al Mitzrayim lefotifar svis paro saratabachim. So I'm going to assume that Midanim is another form of Midyanim, which most commentators do assume. And let's not posit a third group here. But of course, this is again surprising because it sounded like whoever had picked Yosef up out of the pit had sold him to the Ishmaelim. But now the Midanim sold him to Egypt. So we have to figure out what that's all about. And then to make things worse, after the interlude of Perek Lamed Chet, which we'll talk about briefly if we have time at the end, we pick up the story with Yosef's perspective down in Perek Lamed Tet, and we hear Yosef hurad Mitzrayma ve'ekneu Potifar svis paro star tabachim ish mitzri miyad ha'yishma'elim asher horidu hushama. He bought Yosef from the Yishma'elim who had brought him down to there, which is, you know, it's okay back relative back to Pasuk Kaf Chet, but it stands in contrast to Pasuk Lamed Vav here, which had said that the Midanim sold him to Egypt. So we have the Ishmaelim, the Midyanim, and it's going back and forth, and this unclear verb of Vayimshechu Vayalu et Yosef. So that's essentially the puzzle that needs to be detangled here. So who sold who to sold Yosef to whom? Well, here's one view. Rashi says Vayavru Anashim Midyanim Zohi Shayara Acheret. There were two caravans. They saw a Yishmaeli caravan, but then another caravan came with Midyanim. Why do we need to know about those caravans? Because the Torah wants you to know that Yosef was actually repeatedly sold. Vayim Shechu, who picked him up out of the pit? Bnei Yaakov et Yosef min Abor. Vayim Keruhu la Yishmaelim. Vayishmaelim la Midanim. Vamidanim machru otal Mitzrayim. So in Rashi's reconstruction, Bnei Yaakov picked Yosef up out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelim. The Ishmaelim sold him to the Midyanim. The Midyanim sold him to Egypt. If we look back at our text, that does pretty well with almost everything, granting this sort of inefficient two-caravan theory, but putting that aside, except that as Rashi has here, Vamidanim machru otal Mitzrayim, that's all good, but then you have to grapple with Perek Lamed Tet, where it says that Potifar bought him from the Ishmaelim. So Rashi would have to say, and he in fact does say later on, that he bought him indirectly from the Ishmaelim. He bought him from the Midyanim, who bought him from the Ishmaelim. Okay, so that's one approach. Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, has a fascinatingly creative, insightful approach. He's like, wait, let's read this more carefully. Let's look at this again. Okay, all right, let's look. So when we look back at the Psukim, they saw the Ishmaelim. They saw the Ishmaelim. And Yehuda said, let's sell him to the Ishmaelim. Ad kan, we're all good, right? No problem. But then kafchet, vayavru anashim midyanim, vayimshechu vayalu et Yosef. Wait a second. Who picked Yosef up out of the pit? Not the brothers. The brothers aren't even in this pasuk. There is a second caravan, or at least some people. Maybe they're not on camels. Maybe they're not on even on caravan. Maybe they're not going to Egypt at all. But some merchants passed by. You have to assume that Yosef is some remove from the brothers who are sitting and eating. And these merchants pass by and they're like, hey, kid in a pit. Fantastic. Easy money. Easy money because, look, I obviously someone threw him into a pit. I mean, there's obviously something, some bad backstory here. But that's not our problem. He's already in a pit. So all we have to do is sort of put the nail in the coffin, take him out of the pit and figure out what to do with him. And hey, look, there's a caravan of Yishmaelim. So the way Rashbam reads this pasuk, Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim, Midianite merchantmen passed by, they drew and lifted Yosef up out of the pit, and they sold Yosef to the Ishmaelim. Now, for Rashbam then, when Rash, first of all, this is just like a brilliant close reading. He's reading the Pesukim, especially that Pasuk Kafchet, very carefully. And he says, you know, everyone always assumed that it was the brothers who sold Yosef, but maybe it wasn't. It's true the brothers plotted to sell Yosef. I'm not pretending that they were nice people who should be off the hook. They were willing to sell Yosef, if not kill him. But it may be that they never got to pull the trigger because while they were eating behind their backs or, you know, half a kilometer away, these other merchants, these Midianite guys, passed by, picked him up out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelim. If that's true, just think back to that passage in Perek Kaf Bet where the brothers say, you know, oh, we're aval hashemim anachnu, we're guilty for what we did to you. Here, I'll go back to it so we can see what they say. Lo shamano al kein ba'al alino atzara hazot. They never actually say, and we sold him to Egypt. We sold him as a slave. And Reuven, as we observed, seems to think that he's dead. It may be, according to Rashbam at least, it may be that they all think he's dead. They have no idea what happened. They don't know that Chayara'a Chalatu, you know, that's a story they made up to tell their father. But actually, they have no idea what happened to him because it happened behind their back. They didn't even make money off the deal. And as Rashbam says, Zenir Eli Lefi Omek Derech Pshuto Shel Mikra. And this is a phrase that Rashbam uses repeatedly. Omek Pshuto Shel Mikra, the depths of the contextual meaning of scripture, of the Psukim. I hope you're all enjoying the closed captioning on the bottom here, which is having a hard time with some of the things, like, let's try this again. Omek Pshuto Shel Mikra. Yeah, that's fun. Okay. All right, so Rashbam says this. It's picked up by Chizkuni, who's you know, among the Balei HaTosfot, also in his commentary on the Torah, but it's basically abandoned for most of Jewish history. Professor Marty Lukshin, who I think many of you in Toronto know well, actually wrote an article on thetorah.com where he articulates very well and builds up Rashbam's interpretation and points out something I didn't know, that Shadal, Shmuel David Luzzatto, also follows Rashbam. He actually quotes his cousin, Shmuel Chaim ben David Loli, who didn't know about Rashbam, but wrote Shadal this long letter where he also sort of read the parak carefully and came to the conclusion that in fact it was not the brothers who sold Yosef, but the Midianim who sold him to the Ishmaelim, and that's how he got down to Egypt. So I'll just refer you to Rabbi Dr. Lukshin's article for more on that. He does a great job of sort of articulating this and explaining what's attractive about this view. But there is a third view. So there are Rashi, Rashbam, and there's a third view. And the third view is found in Rabbi Yosef Kara, who's Rashi's Talmid Chaver, and Avram Ibn Ezra. And there actually are some places where we know that Yosef Kara's interpretations got to Ibn Ezra. It's conceivable that he heard about it indirectly from him, but it doesn't really matter. Ibn Ezra is slightly younger than Yosef Kara, but they're in different cultural worlds for most of their lives. Doesn't matter whether they influence each other or not, they both have the same view. And that view takes its cue not from primarily a close reading of Perek Lamed Zayin. In other words, they don't start by saying, well, let's read the Pesukim carefully. They start by saying, wait a second, I know something about the terms Midianim and Ishmaelim. Not from Bereishit, I know from later on in Tanakh a really important fact about these two terms. And this they get from Shoftim Perek Chet. I don't have time to just go through the context, but Gideon, the story of Gideon, and he meets the people who had just defeated Midian. So you have the Psukim here, Perek Bet, Akio Shatanu Miyad Midian, V'yomer lehem Gideon, Lo Mishol Ani Bachem, Lo Mishol B'ni Bachem, Hashem Yimshol Bachem, V'yomer lehem Gideon, Esh Alam Ikem She'ela, Tzvir Li Ish Nezem Shlalo, Ki Nizmei Zahav Lahem, ki yishme'elim heim. Gideon says, all I want is the earring or nose ring, the gold rings that you took as plunder. The Midianites have rings. We all know that because they are yishme'elim. In other words, what we're hearing here in Shoftim is that Midianim is actually a subcategory of yishme'elim. So Yosef Kara, in his commentary on Shoftim there, says, ki yishme'elim heim, lemeidim korei yishme'elim, dechtiv v'yavru anashim midyanim socharim, uchtiv v'yim korei Yosef le'yishme'elim. So we learn that they could be called yishme'elim, as it says in Bereishit Lamed Zayin, that the midyanim are yishme'elim. Ibn Ezra, on our pasuk, in Bereishit Lamed Zayin, says the same thing, Ibn Ezra v'yavru, v'chasher avru eila yishme'elim asocharim, ki ha-midyanim yikaru yishma'ilim, b'chein amar al-machei midyan ki yishma'ilim him. So Ibn Ezra also says, when Pasuk Kaf Chet says, the midyanim passed by, that simply identifies them as a type of yishma'ilim. The midyanim were yishma'ilim. I'm not exactly sure if that's how Ibn Ezra would put it, but that's how I'll put it, because I think that's the precise way of putting it. So, in other words, here's what we have. The brothers see a caravan Elim. They don't know what kind of Yishma'elim. They know they're Yishma'elim. As they get closer, Vayavru Anashim Midyanim Socharim. It turns out that they are Midyanim. That's a subtype of Yishma'elim. And that they're merchants, which is probably also important, but I won't pursue it right now. Vayim Kuru, going now, Yosef Kara and Rashbam, going back to the view that this now takes the brothers as a subject, the brothers sold Yosef to the Yishma'elim. Yishma'elim? Yeah, the Yishma'elim. What kind of Yishma'elim? Midyani Yishma'elim, because Midyanim are Yishma'elim. So now, all that's really good, and I think that's quite compelling. In other words, Yosef Kara and Ibn Ezra's idea that there's no contradiction between Yishma'elim and Midyanim. On the contrary, they're synonyms. They're not really synonyms. I think, again, more precise is to say that Midyani is a type of Yishma'eli. But that means that the Torah can go back and forth. Yishma'eli is the general word. Clearly, the brothers, when they're sitting and eating, they couldn't have known that they were Midyanim. They just say they're the Yishma'elim. As they get closer, they say, they're Midyanim, by everyone Hashem Midyanim Socharim. They sell Yosef to the Yishma'elim. Later on, when we hear that the Midyanim brought him to Mitzrayim, we're not troubled by that because we know they're Midyanim. And when we hear that Potiphar, in the beginning of Perek Lamed Tet, bought Yosef from the Yishma'elim, we're not troubled by that either because the Midyanim were Yishma'elim. If that's all right, then there's no problem to answer, like, how could the Torah contradict itself by calling them Yishma'elim or Midyanim? There is, though, a literary question. Why switch back and forth? Why would you call them Yishma'elim and then Midyanim and then Yishma'elim and then Midyanim? Like, what's going on with that? And here, Dr. Steiner has a really interesting suggestion, which I'm going to put on the table and let you mull over, which is that calling them Midyanim seems particularly important rather than just the general term Yishma'elim, because then we have Yosef going down in the hands of Midyanim to be an Ish Mitzri, first to be sold to an Ish Mitzri and then to become an Ish Mitzri. At the beginning of Sefer Shmot, we're going to have an Ish Mitzri, Moshe, who goes to Midyan and becomes a Midyani. And so it might be really important for the Torah to call them Midyanim here, not because we really particularly care what kind of Yishma'elim they are, but because it then sets up this really interesting parallel, really a mirror image of the sale of Yosef being at the hands of the Midyanim going to Egypt, which is going to sort of reverse foreshadow the story of Moshe, who's going to be an Ish Mitzri going to Midyan. And of course, Moshe's identity, I don't know who will be doing Parshat Shmot with you, but Moshe's identity in Perek Bet is just phenomenally, like, deliciously complicated as to who he thinks he is and who he thinks he's not. But the Midyani and Mitzri aspects of his personality, of his character, are played with really extensively in Perek Bet and Shmot. So maybe that's why Midyani is an important term to use here. It sets us up to see the mirror image of this later on in Sefer Shmot. Okay, but now here's my last point about this, and then I'll stop. I'll see if we have time for more things. And that's that you'll notice that I actually defended here two different views. I'm not defending Rashi's view. I think Rashi's view is overly complicated, positing that there are these multiple sales. And again, as I pointed out, it doesn't actually solve all the problems, because later on, the Ishmaelim are said to have sold Yosef to Potiphar, but so are the Midyanim, and that doesn't work out well for Rashi. But the other two views, Rashbam on the one hand, that actually the brothers never sold Yosef. It was the Midyanim who sold him to the Ishmaelim. And Yosef Kara and Ibn Ezra on the other hand, who says that actually the brothers sold him to the Ishmaelim. What kind of Ishmaelim? Midyanim. Both of those, I think, are really quite compelling. At least I'll say that they both work out well in the text. I see no problems with them textually. So why are there two legitimate views? Well, it really hinges on that pasuk kafchet, which is a complicated pasuk. It neglects to tell us the subject of the verb vayimshechu vayalu et Yosef min habor. Or at least according to most, it doesn't. According to Rashbam, it's straightforward, but according to the others, it's sort of implicitly the brothers, but doesn't say that. And I love the point that was made by Ed Greenstein, who taught at Bar Ilan until his retirement a couple of years ago. He's written a lot, but he published a translation of Sefer Iov last year that made a big splash. Because he's worked on Iov for many decades. But actually decades ago, he wrote this really, really nice article called An Equivocal Reading of the Sale of Yosef. He develops things in slightly different ways than we just did this evening, but he also thinks that the story is fundamentally ambiguous as to how Yosef got to Mitzrayim. It's actually not known how Yosef got to Mitzrayim. It can't be concluded with any finality whether Rashbam and Shadal were right, that it was actually the Midyanim who took him out of the pit, or Ibn Ezra and Yosef Kara are right, that it was the brothers who sold him to the Ishmaelim. It's hard to be sure. Now, obviously, as a matter of fact, only one of those could be right. But on a literary level, Greenstein argues that the Torah is trying to be ambiguous. You know why? And this is what makes this a really brilliant article and not just a nihilistic, like, I don't know the answer. Greenstein says, no, the ambiguity is the point. And this is the passage you have in front of you. The story's ambiguity concerning the natural or human chain of events throws into bold relief the actual cause of Joseph's fate. As Joseph himself explains to his brothers, and via the narrative to the reader, he says down in Perek Nun Hay, and then again in Perek Nun, it wasn't you, it was God. By blurring the human factors leading to the enslavement of Yosef, the narrative sharpens our image of the divine factor in bringing it about. In other words, Greenstein's argument is the Torah doesn't want to say exactly how, you know, like sort of neat and clean chain of events, X happened and Y happened, and that's how Yosef got to Egypt. Because that would take away from the point that Yosef actually sees in the story, which is like, I don't know, look, it was complicated. I got thrown in, someone picked me up. Chaos, mess. I couldn't really see what was happening. I don't know, but you know what? It doesn't matter, because obviously the brothers were not good people here, but it wasn't really their doing. It was really a divine plan that got Yosef to Mitzrayim, and by not making it clear which human actors are actually to blame for this, makes it easier to see that actually the humans are only bit players in the narrative anyway. They're just tools in the hand of the actual architect of the story, in other words, in the hands of God. And that ambiguity, that blurriness, that's the blur of what's going on here, I think may mirror Yosef's own experience, but also may highlight, as Greenstein says, the fact that it was really God orchestrating the whole thing. I do want to just end this section with one last point. And that's that later on, Yosef says repeatedly to the brothers, you sold me here. A couple of times he says that. Of course, it's not, the brothers don't argue. The brothers don't say, no, we didn't, which, you know, might seem to be an argument against Rashbam's view, against Rashbam, who said that the brothers didn't tell him at all. But of course, that highlights two things. It highlights, first of all, the fact that all we really know is that Yosef thought the brothers sold him to Mitzrayim, which is not unreasonable at all. Even if the Midyanim, as Rashbam and Shadal argued, actually went behind the brothers' back, pulled Yosef out of the pit and sold him off to the Ishmaelim, and the brothers never knew about it, from Yosef's perspective, Yosef was thrown into the pit by his brothers, and then an hour later, he's dragged out by merchants who sell him off to a caravan going down to Egypt. So he certainly would assume that the brothers were behind this, even if the brothers might not have actually known about it. Of course, Shadal actually does ask the follow-up question, well, so why don't the brothers argue about it? Why don't they say, no, we didn't sell you. We didn't do that. And there are a couple of different answers that are possible there. But of course, one of them, one of the obvious ones is that in fact, if they did that, they would have had to admit something worse. They would have had to say, oh, we didn't sell you. We intended for you to die in the pit, which would, of course, been a very poor defense of their moral integrity at the time where they're incredibly vulnerable. So I say this both because, you know, if you're reading on in the parsha and you're like, the Torah, and you're like, wait a second, but I know the answer because Yosef said that the brothers sold him. So the commentators do know that. And I think it's worth realizing that's Yosef's perspective, not necessarily reflective of what actually happened. The second thing this does, and I'm going to say this really briefly, and I apologize for that, but is that it highlights for us that Yosef's perspective, that any character's perspective, is only their perspective. We might not know whether their perspective, we'll never know whether their perspective is in fact indicative of anyone else's perspective or quote unquote, what actually happened. And that's especially important in our story to answer one other question, which the Ramban asks, which is, why does Yosef not get in touch with his father once he gets down to Egypt? Because the brothers, I understand, but his father, what did he do? But what we just said about Yosef's perspective is the key to that as well. And this is something that Rav Yoel ben Nun suggested in the very first issue of Megadim. And it actually has a response, a pretty angry response, in the very first issue of Megadim from Rav Meidan. But I think Rav Yoel ben Nun's obviously right here. He says, think about Yosef's perspective. Not only is he sure that the brothers sold him, even though we, I think, as readers, can never be totally sure of that, he's also sure that his father set him up for that. Because if we go back two more steps, his father said, hey, go check on your brothers, go see how they're doing. He gets there, he's tossed into the pit, it's all a blur, he's sold down to Egypt. So he knows his brothers did that, and with the same certainty that he knows his brothers did that, he knows his father was in on the plot. The only one that was not in on the plot, Yosef knows, was Binyamin, which is why, of course, once Yosef is ensconced on the throne of Egypt, he wants to get Binyamin down to Egypt to live with him. But his father, he's cut off ties with his father the same way he's cut off ties with his brother. He has no interest in restoring that relationship. In fact, you'll remember that he actually names his first son, Menashe, Nashani Elohim Mikol Amalim Mibeit Avi, right? Thank you, God, for helping me forget my father's house. He is done with his father's house because from his perspective, it's clear that all the brothers and the father were involved in this plot. As I was trying to show, though, from our perspective as a reader, it's not that clear who was actually involved. And as Greenstein argues, that lack of clarity may be actually the theological point, that in a story where God's not mentioned, it's hard to pin blame on any particular humans either. And so the point of that ambiguity, the point of that blur, is in fact to highlight what Yosef says later on. This is all from Elohim. This is all actually a divine plan. All right, I will stop talking there. So there's a bunch in the chat. And certainly if people who didn't put things in the chat would like to say or ask things, I'd love to hear it. I'm just going to read this, but see where that is. So Helene, I wish I knew what I said at 9:13 that you were responding to when you said Rabbi Foreman came to the same conclusion. I don't know what we said, but if you want to tell us now, I'd love to hear. Obviously, that's great. I was Shimon in Yosef and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I was like, ah, that's great. That's actually a good way of learning the story. Right. So, Sandra, that's a great point. So, actually, I'll just point you to Rabbi Lukshin, Dr. Lukshin's article on the Torah.com. He actually has a hypothesis that the reason no one else read the way Rashbam did is actually because of the piyutim of the Asara Harugei Malchut, because it was so ingrained in like traditional Jews' memories in their consciousness from like age 5, that the brother sold Yosef. The brother sold this for 20 shekel. We all know the brother sold Yosef, that even otherwise shot oriented, he wants to attack, didn't know Yosef because of the piyutim and the midrash of the Asara Harugei Malchut. I don't know, when I first read it, I was unconvinced that was as powerful as he thought. But now that you've added your voice to that hypothesis, also maybe it's more plausible than I realized. Rashbam concluded. Okay, great. So, Helene, thank you. I have to assume that Rabbi Foreman knew Rashbam. I'm going to, and Shadal probably. So that's great. And okay, why would Yosef think that his father's part of the plot? So I hope that was clear, right? That from Yosef's perspective, his father sent him to visit the brothers. As far as he could tell, that was all part of setting him up to be sold down to Egypt. But, in case this wasn't clear, the hypothesis that, according to Rashbam and Shadal, that the brothers didn't know about the sale is because they threw him into a pit and then they go a kilometer away to go to a nice grassy hill to eat lunch. And they just don't see that, maybe there's a hill between them. It's not right next to them where they're eating. They don't want to hear his screams as they're eating. It disturbs their wine. So they actually want to be somewhat far away from him, which is why, unfortunately, according to this version of the story, they don't see when other people come and take him out of the pit. So that's clear. All right. So people who didn't put it in the chat, anyone?
Yeah, one other quick question. Just wanted to mention that my son, when he was very, very young, learning the story the first time, and his Rebbe mentioned Midanim and Midyanim, so my son right away said, but Midanim and Midyanim are two. When the generations, when they were introduced in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, there was Midan and Midyan. And he said there were two separate people. So it's very possible that we're dealing with both Midanim and Midyanim in addition to Yishmaelim and whatever. It's just an interesting take from a young child learning Chumash,
That is very impressive. That really is very impressive. It's true. Rashbam on the last pasuk in this perek says Midan and Midyan and Yishmaelim, these are all different people. And so Midan, the key argues there that Midan and Yishmaelim are the same. Midan and Yishmaelim, right. The Midanim and the Yishmaelim are the same, right? Because for him, the Midyanim sold him to the Yishmaelim, but the Midanim are the same as the Yishmaelim for Rashbam. So yeah, that's very impressive that your son remembered names that show up in genealogy.